Welcome to the relaunch of Heidi Matthews On Demand, or HMOD. This is a podcast about international law and politics, culture, sex, and legal regulation, hosted by me, Osgoode Hall Law Professor Heidi Matthews. The first 11 episodes of the show ran in 2019. While I loved doing the show, I pressed the pause button when I became pregnant with twins. That pregnancy rolled into a global pandemic, during which time I birthed and raised said twins, all while working from home. And oh yeah, I also got COVID 4 times, along with a nasty bout of long COVID. It's been a hell of a 4 years. But now that the twins are 3.5, and I'm finally starting to feel like myself again, I'm extremely happy to be back at the pod. This is episode 12, Hague Wars. The Global South Strikes Back. I happen to be a professor of international law with a focus on the law of war, international criminal law, and gender. As we watch the devastation in Gaza, this is a troubling but urgent time to reflect on what international law can and can't offer us. Last week, South Africa and Israel made submissions to the International Court of Justice in South Africa's genocide case against Israel. South Africa alleges that Israel is engaging in genocidal acts, violating the United Nations 1948 Genocide Convention. Specifically, it accuses Israel of 4 acts that, when combined with a special intent to destroy Palestinians living in Gaza in whole or in part, amount to genocide. I'm going to take a little bit of time now to describe those acts, as well as Israel's response before we get into the pod. The first act is killing. South Africa argues that the extensiveness and the indiscriminate nature of the killing in Gaza gives rise to the inference of specific intent to destroy. In its submissions, South African lawyers noted that there's no safe space in Gaza, that designated humanitarian safe areas have been targeted, and that the scale of child killings makes Gaza a graveyard for children, as UNICEF has stated. The second act is causing serious bodily or mental harm. Among other facts, here South Africa described the collapse of the healthcare system in Gaza, the disproportionate impact of the humanitarian situation on women and children, and the systemic detention and torture of Palestinians, including children. The third act is deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Here, South Africa notes that 85% of the population in Gaza has been displaced, that the necessities of life, including food, water, fuel, and medical supplies, have been deliberately cut off. It further noted the widespread destruction of homes and widespread hunger, dehydration, and starvation being experienced by Palestinians in Gaza, as well as the fact that Israel has impeded the effective delivery of humanitarian assistance. The fourth act is imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Here, South Africa noted again the differential impact of the conflict on women and children, who comprise 70% of those killed, with 2 mothers estimated to be killed every hour in Gaza. Pregnant women and young children are particularly impacted by lack of access to medical care, food, water, shelter, and other necessities of life. The WHO has warned about increasing maternal deaths and rates of miscarriages, stillbirths, and premature births, all of which South Africa contends will have impacts that will necessarily be long and lasting and severe for Palestinians in Gaza as a group. In its application to the court, South Africa also compiled a long list of statements by Israeli officials, It argued that when those statements are combined with the level of killing, maiming, displacement, and destruction on the ground, together with the siege, they constitute evidence of specific intent. In defense to these allegations, Israel responded by emphasizing its preferred normative framework. Rather than understanding current events in terms of prolonged and unlawful occupation, as South Africa suggested, Israel argued that the appropriate frame is that of armed conflict. It argued that its military activities have been conducted in self-defense in response to Hamas's attacks on October 7th and are aimed solely at Hamas, not Palestinian civilians. Israel stated that while the effects of current hostilities are, quote, tragic and heartbreaking, civilian deaths have been incurred as the result of lawful targeting and cannot be characterized as evidence of genocidal acts or intent. At this stage, it's important to note that South Africa is requesting the court to order provisional measures, a kind of interim relief, designed to protect Palestinians in Gaza from genocide while the case is being decided on the merits. The threshold for ordering such measures is very low. The court must find that it is plausible that Palestinians in Gaza are experiencing or are at serious risk of genocide. It must further find that there is a real and imminent risk of irreparable prejudice to the rights of Palestinians not to be subjected to genocide or the serious risk of genocide. In this regard, we should recall that Israel argues the court must weigh the interests of Palestinians against those of Israel. In particular, Israel argues that ordering an end to military activities in and around Gaza, which is one of the main but not the only measures requested by South Africa, would cause irreparable harm to Israel's right to self-defense. With me to discuss this case is Alonzo Gourmendi, who is a lecturer in international relations at King's College London. Alonzo's research and writing focus on the history of international legal politics, with a particular emphasis on the role of the Global South in the regulation of war and political violence. He is an expert on the laws of war and the use of force, as well as on issues of Latin American international politics and security. He's also a contributing editor for the international law blog Opinio Iuris. His commentary on international law and politics on Twitter is absolutely not to be missed. You can find him there at Alonzo_GD. Enjoy the show. Okay. Hi, Alonzo. Thank you so much for agreeing to have this friendly little podcast chat today.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for inviting me. This is, I expect this to be super fun. So,
so we're here to talk, of course, about what it seems curiously, actually, the whole world is talking about in some ways. In other words, the South African genocide case against Israel, which was heard last week at the stage of the request for provisional measures. So we're going to break that down, I think, for the listeners in simple terms first, and then maybe we can have a little bit more of a detailed conversation about what your and my own sort of legal takeaway points are. But I think it's helpful to do kind of a general breakdown because we don't know exactly who's going to be listening to the episode. So yeah, you're the perfect person to have here. So I'm very, very grateful. This is super fun. So I'm going to just start. I don't want this to be sort of like a question and answer. We'll just have a chat. But what, in your opinion, like, why are people so interested in international law once again? I mean, obviously, we have this very sensational context, right, of Gaza. And anytime we start leveraging discourse or arguments around genocide, people are going to get really excited and amped up. And if you apply that to the Israeli context, it's going to be, you know, times a million. But I've found it kind of as a broadly speaking, really fascinating that folks have turned their attention in recent days to the International Court of Justice, right? Which is just not part of the political discourse, you know, really 99.9% of the time. So, yeah, I mean, do you think, I'll just let you, yeah, go ahead. What's your takeaway on that?
Well, I mean, the I think it's one of the first times that I've seen the ICJ trending on Twitter. So
exactly, yeah.
It is weird to me, but I guess so. I guess there's two kinds of I guess reactions that I'm seeing. One is this like, oh, this is very interesting. This is like this is new. I want to be informed about it, and that one I think it's positive. I think it's good. It means that the rules-based order is leaving the obscure you know, alleys of the UN and the these like diplomatic statements that only I read, and it's getting into the people are wanting explanations, particularly explanations that are more complex than, look, this is what genocide is, and this is the mens rea, and this is the actus reus, and when you combine both, you have a crime, and this is what's legal, and this is what's illegal. You know, very sterile, very technical legal discussion. I think people are getting more interested, which I find amazing, in critical takes on this, and on saying, okay, but genocide is itself a politicized term, and there's a reason why this specific thing that we're seeing here, where a non-affected state, particularly a global south state, can take a Western state, Western ally, however you want to call it, to the International Court of Justice, is weird. So why is it weird? And I want to know. That's really cool. There's another kind of answer, a response to this, that I think it's more complicated. It requires a little bit more of a, on the one hand, understanding, and on the other hand, like, okay, It can get concerning. And it's the how dare you approach. This idea of how dare you, you being people that believe that South Africa did the right thing, or South Africa itself in filing this case, saying, how dare you bring this case against us? Like, don't you realize that we are not supposed to be the ones who get, you know, accountability for what we're doing? And we are, you know, beyond this kind of like, this is I related a lot to this critique from African countries that say the ICC only cares about Africa and that's it. If you have an investigation into US crimes, it takes forever, and then they don't really investigate the US and so on and so forth. So, and the correlation to that is like, yeah, it is supposed to be for those countries, not for us. And I made quotation marks with my hands. I think it reminds me of when we were talking a lot about universal jurisdiction back when I was in law school. And I was like, oh yeah, this is the future. This is a moment of accountability. And this was Global North led. It was like usually Belgium, for example, had this like huge universal jurisdiction law. But it still created this like Bomb the Hague Act in the US. And Belgium was basically forced to amend its legislation because the US said, well, then you're not going to be the seat of NATO. And I think it's the reaction is even more outraged when it's South Africa. And especially when it's Israel, which is also a very, like Germany calls it its reason of existence, or the reason for the German state is the protection of Israel. So there is a lot of like, this like outraged reaction that I think it's more it requires deeper exploration, because it's not just like, oh, all of these people are fascists. No, I mean, there's a lot of people that are genuinely surprised, like, this could happen to us, this could happen to me, I don't compute. So it requires more exploration, but it is the side of the trending, I guess, section of the ICJ that I'm more concerned with, that I don't feel is such a positive step.
Yeah, so there's been, you know, so for both of us who, I think, you know, it's fair to say we just come at law from a broadly critical perspective, right? So I don't think you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I don't think either of us, you know, would look at legal interventions with a like a prima facie sort of positive attitude, right? There's a deep, deep skepticism. For anybody who is concerned, you know, with rights-based or freedom-based movements, especially those emanating from the global South, and as they play out, as particularly in, you know, powerful states of the global North, and where those two kind of worldviews get mixed up a bit, we see that. I think both of our home countries probably, you know, so we come at law with a deeply skeptical attitude. And, you know, that's surprising to folks who are outside of the legal domain in their sort of everyday life, and certainly who are outside of the legal academy. I think it's a surprising thing when people say, like, actually, we're skeptical about using these discourses as a mode of sort of achieving emancipation, essentially, right? Or various sorts of human rights claims or freedom-based claims in general. So that's a surprising thing. I think it's worth bearing it out a little bit, right? So what is it that's concerning for you in particular about the kind of elation and sort of left-wing euphoria that we've seen, right? And I want to, you know, intuitively, it's very, very attractive to feel that as well, especially, you know, as we're seeing worldwide protests have gone for over 3 months right now, you know, real sort of uprising in public opinion around the world. It's easy to really get excited and energized by these legal interventions, especially when they come, as you say, from, you know, a state in the global South, and particularly a state such as South Africa, which has, you know, its unique history of apartheid and having overcome apartheid, but then entered a different sort of type of issue. But yeah, so describe that for folks. Like, why would those of us who are on the left, broadly speaking, and why would we be skeptical of this excitement around South Africa's case, at least in part?
Yeah, I mean, the way I processed this in my mind was I didn't want to feel that I was skeptical so much as I'm very cautious about being too optimistic about it, because there is a little bit of me that goes like, yeah, this is really cool, but then I remember, right? Then I remember what I do for a living and the things that I read, and it sort of hits me that we have. So I guess I would start with the general idea that the way that the international community is regulated is not neutral, right? It is based on a series of understandings that usually come from the global North, that have a history of colonialism, have a history of Eurocentrism and imperialism. That was, to use the mainstream term, it expanded, quote unquote, into the rest of the world because it was such a good system, you know, like everyone liked it. So everyone adopted it and everyone became a nation state. And there's no other natural way of doing things other than being an nation state, meaning that, you know, Peru for Peruvians, Canada for Canadians, and anyone else is a minority. And so that basic structure of the system creates a few problems, because for me, and I know for you as well, we have both had to deal with people rejecting the idea that what our countries did to create that idea of the nation, the Peruvian nation, the Canadian nation, was genocide. In Peru, at least, like the notion of Peruvianness is tied up to an independent movement that was basically the great-great-great-grandchildren of Spanish, you know, colonizers, who decided, not even decided, I want to be independent. The history of Peruvian independence is a mess. It's like Argentinians decided, you know, for us to be independent and trade more, you have to be independent. So how about we just keep everyone who isn't white still in a colonial relationship with the people who are white? And we call that a nation state. And so all the indigenous communities that lived in the country, they were subjected to a different level of citizenship, right? And without sidetracking too much into Peruvian history, that meant a lot of genocide, because there was a lot of ample land that was quote-unquote empty in the Amazon, and the Peruvian nation had to get it, right? And there's several examples of this in proven history, and it's the same with Canada and with the residential schools. And we are comfortable with this idea. You and me, we're comfortable with this idea of, yeah, genocide is foundational. Genocide is common. And then we look at the history of this system that the international community created. And it's a system that eventually decided, yeah, you know what? We need more raw materials. So we need to go to Africa and get those raw materials. Right. And in getting those raw materials, it's not enough to trade with them anymore in the coastlines. We need to go inside Africa and colonize it. And that system was colonial and therefore genocidal. There's a lot of episodes where European countries just committed genocide in Africa, Germany, Belgium, you know. And so it is foundational. But in the European or, let's say, Western mindset, it isn't, because the Western mindset only started to think about the very idea of genocide at the earliest with the Armenian genocide, at the earliest, right? And even that genocide was like that sort of faraway genocide that's in Turkey, that's not really part of us, and like it's different, right? But and the moment when that became a mainstream concern is after the Holocaust. Which, of course, was like, it is the most systematic genocide that we've experienced. But it's not the blueprint of genocide. It's just applying something that had been applied in all over the world to European citizens. And in an extremely systematic way, in an extremely horrendous way. And then everyone started thinking about it, and that became the blueprint. And so when we regulated, the international community, regulated what genocide was, it was premised on this idea that genocide is something that you should only experience once in your lifetime. It's not something common. The bar for genocide needs to be that high because it is the crime of crimes. It's not like war crimes. It's not like crimes against humanity. It's something that should only happen rarely. So you need to prove this genocidal intent, and that genocidal intent needs to be the only reasonable inference. Right, of if there's any other explanation, if your intent was to commit massive war crimes, then it can't be genocide because it's massive war crimes. And that creates a very difficult situation because genocide is not rare. What is rare is findings of genocide. And that is where my skepticism comes from. Is we have a system that is thought out from the perspective of a community of peoples that were committing genocides, were not being the victims of genocide. And so we end up with a system based on, oh, you remember that one time that there was this horrendous act? Let's think of genocide from the perspective of that one act. And of course, historically, I can understand that, but it does create a problem, because then how many genocides have there been in my lifetime, right, since 1985? And how many genocides have there been since the 20th century? Right, and if we go by findings of genocide so far, like the Holocaust, Rwanda, maybe some people might count Armenia, although there's no big, you know, international tribunal. Even Serbia, which is just Srebrenica's genocide, and that's it. There's no more. Right. Whereas for me, okay, let's start. You know, the genocide of the Matses in Peru, the genocide of indigenous communities in the Amazon in Brazil, genocide in Canada, and you know, just keep on going, right? So for me, there's been plenty of genocides. I just can't prove that they were genocide, and that's the place where my skepticism, my hopelessness comes from. Like we are trying to do something that I think should be easy or easier. Yeah. With a system that makes it very difficult.
Yeah. No, I think it's really important. So like both to sort of temper expectations, but for people to understand the way that law distributes power in the world, right? So genocide is very simply, as you've just said, it was not meant to be something that was available really as a mode of redress. It's not meant to be something that's actively available to peoples who are struggling against, you know, various forms of colonial domination and other sorts of oppression. It's not meant to be a tool that's available to those peoples, or even, you know, here for an unaffected or a tangentially affected third state to be able to bring this kind of claim. So yeah, I wonder, there's something as a Canadian, right? There's something interesting going on though in, let's say, like the last 10-ish years of, you know, imaginings about ourselves in the world. But I think, I mean, I don't know if I'd have to think a little bit harder about whether this applies more broadly to other Western nations. But I think even if you think more expansively about movements like Black Lives Matter, right, in the U.S. and sort of other kinds of uprisings in the Middle East, and even similar sorts of efforts in Europe, there's this willingness in a very sort of neoliberal and limited fashion. I want to be clear about that. And even if you want to think about it, it's like completely compatible in many ways with a colonial logic, this sort of tiny movement towards the acceptance of the fact that like colonialism existed, or correlatively that we need to do decolonization, whatever that means, right? In Canada, that can mean, you know, having a wing of the prison where, you know, that's shaped like an eagle. So that's something that actually happened recently in the Canadian context. And again, I sort of chuckle there just again based on the absurdity of this kind of thing. But those are the sorts of moves that we have, right? So the discourse has started to change a little bit in the Canadian context. We have this movement with two government sort of efforts, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which had jurisdiction over, you know, loosely speaking, jurisdiction over the Indian residential schools, the so-called Indian residential schools, and then a national inquiry on murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. And we had genocide findings in both of those contexts. Obviously, those findings don't have concrete legal repercussions, but in the wake of them, we have the government kind of, you know, actually coming out and saying, yeah, genocide was something that happened. They didn't go so far as to say, you know, Canada's bear state responsibility for it, but they will describe the actions as genocidal in some sense. And as I sort of alluded to, I think we see that kind of thinking emerging with regard to some other movements as well. And so, you know, I think that the extremely pessimistic read is to say, yes, but all of that is always already captured by like the liberal forces, whatever, that are in play. Which is probably true, or is there a less pessimistic view of the fact that that kind of language exists in you know, in circulation in mainstream political discourse?
Yeah, I think so. This is tricky because it's sort of like predicting the future, and I don't know what the future holds. But there is a, I do see a trend in what is most concerning to reactionary forces right now. And it is very strange to see that the most, you know, concerning things out there right now are critical race theory, decolonization theory, decolonial theory, Black Lives Matter, equality, diversity, and inclusion. These didn't used to be the biggest threats to the, let's say, anti-rights mindset. It used to be, at least in Peru, it used to be more like, oh, the Inter-American Commission and Court of Human Rights, or it used to be same-sex marriage. It used to be the idea that, you know, women's rights, all of these like more traditional things of, I guess, a more liberal approach of human rights advancement were troubling to the reactionary mind, as in, oh, what do you mean you're bringing down this part of my social structure? The difference I see with DEI, with Black Lives Matter, critical race theory, decolonial theory, and this whole fear of the woke that we are seeing right now, is that those theories are not specific interventions. It's not, let's grant rights to this minority. It's the entire structure is broken and we need to flip it. And so when you see that, no longer as a, oh yeah, those are those crazy people in those little discussion groups and reading groups in the universities, there's people actively telling you this is the culture war, then yes, it's going to suck kind of necessarily, because there's going to be a lot of like censorship and persecution, and like people are going to start, I don't know, surfing through tweets and stuff like that. Yes, but at the same time, it reveals a growth of these theories and a strength in these theories that didn't used to be here. So when you frame the South African case in the context of states that are doing things that 20 years ago, we would never dream of this happening. South Africa suing Israel for genocide. Namibia, I think it was today, maybe it was yesterday, just scolding Germany over, you know, their double standards with genocide. Mauritius taking, you know, the UK to the International Court of Justice over decolonization with Chagos. Gambia and with Myanmar, and all of these like interventions. Yes, there's still Westphalian nation states. It still has its problems. Like the Chagosians will tell you that there's still problems. But there is some hope in that what we're seeing is not just this co-opting of the term, that we're operating within the same structure that will never let, quote unquote, us win. But that it's chinks in the armor of this structure. Because, I mean, there's a Brazilian political scientist, Oliver Stunkel, who talks about the post-Western world. And he talks about how there's like emerging powers, Brazil, South Africa, India, that are slowly trying to produce a new set of rules, a new kind of like, not a rules-based order, but a different kind of order, whatever that may be. And there is a scenario where that rules-based order is horrible, that new rules-based order is horrible. We see that with like the kind of discussions emerging in India right now with like, Hindu supremacist discourses. But there is a scenario where like, there are actors that can become, that can gain power not to bend rules, but to enforce them. And I guess that's where my hope lies, that we have this opportunity to see global South states and states that didn't usually participate in these kinds of discussions, enforcing these rules. And hopefully this is the baby steps, because we're definitely not there yet. The double standards with Russia are, you know, patents everywhere as well. So, but if I situate this South Africa case within this broader concept of, we are starting to challenge the structure, and the structure is starting to say, oh, these challenges are actually worth declaring our biggest enemy. I guess there's a sprinkle of hope there that this will not all be for naught.
Yeah. And I initially, whenever the South Africa made its application at the end of December last year, sounds like a long time ago now, but roughly 2 weeks ago, I sort of wondered, okay, so what's going to happen is Israel going to, you know, they have two options, really. They could do what you've just described. They could take this extremely seriously, put together this, you know, very erudite and professional, although not necessarily professional, acting legal team to defend, you know, South Africa's claims, or they could, you know, play the Russia card and just be like, you know, international law is irrelevant. It's particularly irrelevant for us. It always has been. We're not going to deign to even answer the application, right? It just doesn't exist, and we're not going to even show up to defend ourselves. And we see, we see the commitment to some form of law or legal adjudication happening, even though to an extent, I think we saw this in the hearing, you know, there was some grandstanding. There was some of this, you know, you need to understand Israel is effectively immune from genocide. But on the other hand, you know, we didn't see the kind of spectacularization of the proceedings that a lot of folks had predicted. And that was sort of rumored to perhaps be in the works when people were wondering about, you know, whether Israel is going to play at some, the videos that it's been in taking around the world of the atrocities on October 7th. We didn't see that. It was actually pretty sterile, mostly, or that was my read. Where am I going with that? I guess we're in, you know, a few days after the hearings, like a pretty firmly established set of legal trappings for a really profound challenge to the legal structure as it's been set up, which is super fascinating and like theatrical in its own sense, right? And you've really set that up nicely. Okay, so we're in this universe where Israel is taking the thing pretty seriously. You know, it's not necessarily going to comply with whatever. So how much matters, though, in terms of the formal legal outcome? And I think there are two stages to this, right? So both from a like a law perspective in terms of developing and advancing the jurisprudence, but also a political strategy perspective. So I think you're right, as you've observed, the special intent required for genocide is difficult to prove and may well, you know, not be made out on the merits in this case, for the reasons that you briefly highlighted. From a strategy perspective, what difference will it make if provisional measures are ordered? And how can we think about, or how should we think about the measures that may be ordered, right? So if folks don't know already, South Africa has requested essentially unilateral ceasefire in the sense that they've asked the court to ask Israel to suspend military operations in and around Gaza. But it's also asked for a series of other sort of far less dramatic but still really meaningful measures. So I don't know if what I said just makes sense, but is there a value, to the case, even if it fails at the merit stage? How should we think about that value? And, you know, what are the measures? How do we think about the provisional measures in relation to that broader strategy question?
Yeah, definitely. I think, so again, I don't want to be the very negative one. So I do want to reserve this scenario where South Africa pulls off an amazing victory and that's the main effect. But I also think it's important to bear in mind that even for Palestine itself, there are other very important victories to be had here that don't necessarily relate to a finding of that this entire operation was genocide. By the time this case ends, this will be several years into the future. So I hope that by then, Israel is no longer bombing Gaza. But I mean, at this point, who knows? But we need to think both in terms of the immediate redress for the catastrophic humanitarian disaster that Israel is creating in Gaza. That is a very important battlefront of this case. And then there's the more systemic wins that we can accomplish from here to, well, that Palestine can accomplish from here to like a few years into the future. So in terms of the immediate aftermath, the immediate result right now, I don't think that the court is just going to pull a Ukraine v. Russia thing here and say ceasefire and that's it, because of the self-defense issues that's something to discuss in the second part of the strategic victories. The whole self-defense discussion is not going to be resolved in 20 pages of provisional measures. So I don't think that's going to be the case. There's going to be probably some level of like, don't attack hospitals, like give more food and water to Gaza. I don't know. Allow the press in. Allow a fact-finding mission in. You know, and all of those things will be hugely important already, because they will provide avenues for civil society to pressure governments and to activate domestic mechanisms that, you know, keep. They're not designed for the Israels of the world. But they're designed to keep states from engaging with countries that have some sort of like level of you violate human rights, right? In the US, I think it's called the Leahy Act, something like that, to keep it from, you know, trading with, collaborating militarily with countries that violate human rights. All of those things are important. And so I'm thinking, I don't know how the provisional measures will look like, but they will look something around the lines of, look, if Hamas sends missiles, of course you can, you know, repel those missiles. But if you are doing your operations in Gaza to like, you know, rescue hostages, if that's the military objective that you're pursuing here, then you need to target your measures a lot more. You need to be more mindful of, you know, actually protecting civilians, it is not possible that 80% of the people with extreme hunger in the world live in Gaza. Something in those lines. That would be great if it already slows down the machinery in Gaza, because the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is completely man-made and it's completely Israel-made. Like, as much as Israel wants to go to the ICJ and say that it's all Hamas's fault, I mean, at some point we need to be responsible for our own actions and our own bombs. And so it would be great if the provisional measures can deal with that. Of course, not through a ceasefire, but through other more creative, more nuanced mechanisms. And then on the more strategic... Yeah, sorry, go on.
Go ahead with your strategic... No, please finish your thought. Yep.
And then with the strategic victories, I think Israel is making an interesting gamble here, because it is going for the, I guess, the big kahuna, right? The self-defense argument that you cannot order a ceasefire because I have an inherent right to self-defense in vis-a-vis Hamas. And it's a very old claim by Palestine to say, well, if you're occupying Palestinian territory, you cannot have a right to self-defense over a territory where you are already exercising force, right? So it would be very interesting to see what the court says about this, because Israel's principal argument on this is you cannot order the same kind of provisional measures that you ordered for Ukraine v. Russia, because in that case, it was a sheer act of aggression by Russia into Ukraine. Rightly so. And so, of course, Russia had no right to use force in Ukraine. So you could order Russia to get out of Ukraine. That's not the same case with Israel, because Israel does have a right to self-defense in Gaza, which begs the immediate question. And you can, it's not, the answer is not going to cover the West Bank, but you can extrapolate the answer to the West Bank. The immediate question that you should ask is, okay, what is the legal basis for your use of force in Gaza, parenthetical, and in the West Bank, right? Because there is a blockade going on. There's still effective control over Gaza by Israel, and the West Bank is under military occupation. And Gaza as well, but different. It's denied by Israel. And so it cannot be the original reason for occupying Gaza and the West Bank, because that there's a peace treaty with Egypt and there's a peace treaty with Jordan. The original occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was the product of the war with Egypt and Jordan. That war has ended. Those two wars have ended with very clear peace treaties. So if that's not the reason for being in Gaza, what is, right? And then we can start talking about whether, okay, is there a right to self-defense against non-state actors in the territory of another state? Or, okay, the occupied Palestinian territories, but for me, a state. And that's a huge discussion, and I think very controversial. And I think the court has leaned towards, so far, saying, no, there is no self-defense against non-state actors. So, okay, big problem. And then the other one is there's no non-state armed group in the West Bank. So could it be that the occupation of Palestine doesn't have a legal basis and therefore is an act of aggression itself? And so, of course, you have a right to defend your national. You have a right to protect your population from an attack by Hamas. And of course, like if they're attacking a music festival and you have police and troops nearby, of course you need to protect that population. Like, of course. And if they take hostages from you, then of course you should go to the owner of that land, the state of Palestine, and say, look, there's people from my state in your territory. We need to do something together to get them out. Right, of course, no one is saying, I hear this a lot, like, oh, what do you want? For the hostages to die? No, of course you should do something. But of course we need to get these people out of there. I think it's like a horrendous experience to think about this. But if you approach it from this like mindset of self-defense, you forget that this is the territory of another state. Whether Israel recognizes it or not, I mean, at this point, seems kind of silly to say that Palestine is not a state. And so, yes, you should go to that state and say, there's an armed group in your country that is keeping my people against their will. We need to do something to solve this problem. And once you're talking about a we, Israel-Palestine, the we, then yes, there is room for negotiations. There is room for a political solution to the conflict beyond October 7th, the entire conflict, right? And then we can talk about what shape that can take. But I mean, the only reason why Israel is talking about the two-state solution being dead is because they are concentrated exclusively on the right to self-defense and the idea that the Palestinian state cannot possibly be armed in any way because it is an existential risk. But this whole thing exists because we cannot think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as anything other than a self-defense conflict. Instead of there's an armed group in your territory and I need your help to get my hostages back.
Yeah. No, that was just a beautiful summary and sort of skeletal sense of where the court, you know, could go or legal thought could go with respect to actually envisaging a jurisprudentially like defensible description of the conflict and what an eventual resolution can be in terms of just setting up a scenario where self-defense is not kind of the answer to all of the queries on the table. And I think, you know, that's it's become such a facile go-to argument that's just an absolutely essential to sweep away in order for us to make sense of what's happening on the ground. So we've been talking for quite a while, but I want to ask you one final question that
sure.
sort of brings together the beautifully articulated, hopeful legal case that you've just laid out, as well as some of the trepidation that we talked about maybe at the beginning. And so I want to sort of gesture or really just tackle head on, you know, how folks are feeling really across the world in this moment, right? So many people just feel, you know, they don't really have the tools at their disposal to understand what's going on. And I think that's why it's important to have these conversations, right? Just to help help people understand, you know, what does it mean when we talk about self-defense actually? And as you know, it's so important to say, when we say that Israel doesn't have the right of self-defense in this particular case, it doesn't mean that they can't protect their citizens from being killed when others are opposing them, right? And that would be the situation, you know, just domestically in a peacetime situation in any state, you know, on the planet. Obviously, the individual, like Hobbesian right of self-defense still exists and nobody's suggesting otherwise. That's super important. But in terms of, folks need to be given the tools to understand the situation outside of the really profoundly unhelpful frameworks and language that are used sort of in the mainstream media descriptions of what's happening. But I think, you know, once they have that too, people are still feeling really impotent and really like they can't do anything, like they're being forced to sort of watch a genocide unfold. And even if we don't call it a genocide, we just call it like massive atrocity, right? On a scale that we haven't seen in, you know, a long, long time. People are really upset about that and being just affected on a kind of like, in really important ways that I think it's important to talk about. So part of what you've really helpfully done in your Twitter interventions is to keep this like meticulously documented running tally. I couldn't not talk about what states are supporting South Africa or really a tally of state position in general in South Africa. You've got a fantastic infographic, et cetera. So folks should definitely check that out. You're helping us keep on top of, the who's saying what in the political sphere. So armed with that knowledge, my thought for you is like, what can ordinary folks do right now with respect to the conflict, right? How can they pressure, how can they find out basically what their government's position is and where are the pressure points that we need to think about applying? And of course, it's going to be different depending, you know, on where we are in the world and who we are in the world. But I think it's important to talk about.
So I think with your permission, I'm going to hijack your question to answer something else that popped through my head while you were making that question. And then I'll answer your question, because I think it's important. This case is having a very personal effect on people, not just people who are pro-Palestine, but people, especially including people who are pro-Israel. There is a very big emotional component on this. And I say this as someone that who can actually understand on a personal level what it feels to feel vulnerable, I don't claim to have survived anything similar to October 7th or the bombing of Gaza or anything like that. But I did grow up in a country where when someone left their homes in the morning, you weren't exactly sure if they were going to go to that neighborhood and then one bomb would go off and kill someone you love, or someone you love would get kidnapped. Like, I have relatives that were kidnapped by armed groups. I have and I don't say this like to for any kind of sympathy. I'm saying like to from a personal point of view, I do understand what it does to your mind. The reason why I do what I do for a living is that I needed an outing for what otherwise became a need for revenge. Like when I was 14, 13, and I needed to understand what was going on in the world around me, my immediate gut reaction was revenge. And as I grew older and I saw what that was doing to my mind, I didn't like it. And so I needed some other way of venting. And that's how I got to international humanitarian law, because we had a very big discussion in Peru at around the time that I was, you know, finishing school, entering college, law school specifically, but whether what we had lived, this thing that had like kidnapped my uncle and like threatened my dad, was it an armed conflict or not? And what does that mean? And of course, Peru being Peru, it became this like, if you say it was an armed conflict, you're a terrorist. And if you think it wasn't an armed conflict, you're a fascist. And no one really went deeper. So I started to read about that. And I found an outing in this, like, at that time, me thinking neutral, quote unquote, body of rules that could tell me, okay, this is what you're allowed to do. This is what you're not allowed to do. And my first book, when I entered into academia, was explaining that. Explaining, okay, what does it mean for it to be an armed conflict? And of course, it's funny how when you finish writing a book, you sort of like have the idea for the next one. And the first thing that I discovered is that, yeah, it wasn't such neutral as I thought. And I ended up writing a PhD thesis on why IHL is all just like, you know, not neutral at all. But that's another story. The point is that I understand the feeling of vulnerability that comes with October 7th. And I think it is important to not dismiss it, because there is trauma with this. It is difficult. People have to deal with it. They have to come to terms with yes, I want revenge, but that is not good. And I am not going to do that. Therefore, I will find this other outing. Some people find religion. Some people find IHL. Some people find whatever you find. That doesn't happen overnight. And so I do think it is important that we acknowledge that and give people some time, not infinite time. And I think we're getting into that realm of like, okay, it's been 3 months, right? And these reactions, you sort of need to be aware of the fact that this has happened to other people before. I've seen stuff written in English about the Shining Path, the group that led the Peruvian armed conflict. Basically glorifying, if you Google Shining Path or you search for Shining Path on Twitter, the amount of accounts that glorify the Shining Path is huge. It bothers me. I have a physical reaction when I see the face of the leader of the Shining Path. It's weird. I don't like it. And we live in an academic community that has for decades. Let's say, think of the drone program. In the US drone program, when I was in law school, what we were writing about, we as an academic community were writing about is, do we, meaning the US, have a right to bomb this city? This city was never London, it was never New York, it was always Islamabad, it was always Kabul, it was always Sana'a, Mogadishu. It was never London, it was never New York, it was never Chicago. And yeah, it was very nonchalantly talked about. Like, I remember being in law school, I was like, okay, yeah, can we, you know, send the battalion and, like, you know, shoot someone shoot Anwar al-Awlaki in Pakistan because he's saying the wrong things, right? I can only imagine what that felt for a Pakistani or an Arabic person, an Arab person, or anyone in the Middle East thinking, are you seriously writing that the bomb that's falling, the drones, that there's so much written about the psychological effect of living under drones? And there's someone out there that read that scholarship and said, like, are you really writing about this? And felt triggered and felt what I felt when I saw someone glorifying the Shining Path. And so now we are seeing this again with our Jewish and Israeli colleagues and friends and loved ones. And they've become part of that pattern. And they have access to us in ways that, maybe an Iraqi or a Pakistani didn't have, because global academia is not global. Right. So I feel like it is important in that process of like, okay, yes, this is terrible. This does want me. This is traumatic and does want, it makes me want revenge. Feeling part of a community of people that have gone through this is useful to coping with this. And what we, the people who have gone through this, need to live healthy lives. I mean, you can always become a hateful person that hopes everyone dies. But the people who have lived through this, we can live in a community that accepts that, we're not alone. We are not being ostracized for having gone through this. It's just that in Peru, killing every single person that was suspiciously Shining Path was immoral. I can't like that. It won't be healthy for me. I can't want that. And so we find this broader community. And you don't need to wipe out Gaza to overcome that. You need to know that you're not alone, that you're not the only one that's gone through this. And we will be there for each other. And I think that's something that is ignored about this problem. That it's really very black and white. Oh, are you pro-Israeli? You monster. Right? And it shouldn't be that way. We should be, of course, there are people that are monsters. Several, from what I've seen. Many masks have come off. But not everyone. So I think we should be aware of that. So that's, I guess, people in my situation, that we've been through stuff. We can do that. You were asking me what people can do. We can do that. And then we can also, I guess it is important, something that Namibia just did, right? Break the cycle of normalization of oppression and genocide, and like this idea that everything was fine. One thing that when people that vote for Trump were like, make America great again. When was it great? Oh, when Jim Crow, segregation, when was it great? Right? And something like that happens as well at the international level. When was international law great? The Berlin Conference? Or, the mandate system? Or what? The Algerian Revolution? When was it great? And so one thing people can do is share those experiences. We're in a global community. Everyone has a story. Like that's one thing that I'm talking too much. I know that, but like I think this is important. There's a mistake. People think the global South is a Westphalian concept, where you have nation states that are global South and nation states that are global North, and that's not true. There are global South people in Canada. There are global South people in the U.S. African Americans have a global South experience because they have dealt with oppression, systemic oppression. They have dealt with colonialism. They have dealt with slavery. They have dealt with all of these global South. Me, as a white Peruvian, I have some claim to global Southerness because of my migrant condition, and I come from a country that is barely even talked about. I see Peru anywhere, and I go like, yes, Peru, that's for yay. But I'm not the indigenous person from Peru that was excluded from society for like 200 years and is only now starting to express its dissatisfaction. So this idea that global South and global North is a Westphalian concept is wrong. And there's a lot of global South people and people with solidarity for the global South that have stories, have experiences. And they know that international law was never great. And that should be shared. It's what Namibia did to Germany, and we can all do that to our Germanys. That was a very long answer.
No, so it's fantastic. It's so beautiful. Thank you. Thanks so much for taking the time, Alonzo. This has been fabulous. We could talk certainly all day. And I'm only leaving you because my children are beginning to lose it and need to go to bed. But this was just tremendous. Thank you so, so much for joining me.
No, it was wonderful. I can do it again, and we can talk for another hour. That's fine.
Okay, I'll stop the recording.